welcome to friends old and new to the Centre for Myth, Cosmology and the Sacred. And on behalf of myself, Mary and Angela, who can't be with us this evening, the three directors of the Centre for Myth, Cosmology and the Sacred, we are delighted to welcome Dr. Becca Tarnas to the Centre. And so it's my pleasure to introduce Becca. Becca is a scholar, artist and editor of Arche, the Journal of Archetypal Cosmology. She received her doctorate in philosophy and religion from the California Institute of Integral Studies, CIIS, with a dissertation titled The Back of Beyond, the Red Books of C.G. Jung and J.R.R. Tolkien. Her research interests include depth psychology, archetypal studies, literature, philosophy, and the ecological imagination. She teaches at both Pacifica Graduate Institute and CIIS, and is the author of the book Journey to the Imaginal Realm, A Reader's Guide to J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. And Becca currently lives in Northern California. So Becca, over to you. It's a pleasure to welcome you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Louise and Mary, and my thanks also go to Angela. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be here and speak for this beautiful audience. And thank you everyone who has taken time out of your day or your evening midweek to come attend this presentation. When I was first asked to speak for the Center for Myth, Cosmology, and the Sacred, what a beautiful name. I was invited to speak about something new I was working on, a topic which could be a little more open and experimental, and that it needn't adhere to the strictures of, or all of the strictures of the academy. So I decided to take that invitation seriously, and I proposed a talk on something I've been exploring internally, just for my own interest over the last few years, and especially in the last several months. And this is the topic of astrological magic. So both astrology and magic are taboo subjects in the academy for the most part, unless they're spoken of in historical or and often condescending terms. They're really seen as these kind of relics of a superstitious past. So to give you some context, I have been a practicing archetypal astrologer for the last dozen or so years. I'm also a second generation astrologer. So I was raised in a milieu of astrological and archetypal language, even though I didn't turn serious attention to the subject until early adulthood, when it became clear that this was my calling. This is what I was supposed to be doing in the world. So an understanding of archetypes and how they relate to planetary alignments has been really essential to my practice. Now, from a different angle, as you heard in the bio, for my PhD research, I explored numerous parallels that I found between, on the one hand, the Red Book of Carl Gustav Jung and the Red Book of Westmarch of J.R.R. Tolkien, which is the name given to the manuscript of The Lord of the Rings within the context of the story. So through that research, I explored the terrain of imagination, what is the imagination, as well as visionary experience, the mundus imaginalis, or the imaginal realm, and also the phenomenon of synchronicity. So my sources were already pointing me towards another field of knowledge that I'd completely overlooked or had dismissed as unreal or unbelievable. And like astrology, for any of you who practice astrology, are curious about astrology, engage with it, the moment has to be right when you encounter something like that. So the moment has to be right to encounter magic and take it seriously, and to realize that it isn't the dramatic wand waving and sudden conjurings of the popular imagination. It often comes in during a moment of crisis, maybe personal crisis, as a kind of grace that allows one to see the world in a new way. The basic premise of astrological magic, from my still growing and evolving understanding, is based in the theory of correspondences that was present in the medieval era. So the theory of correspondences, it's basically the idea that certain material substances correspond with different planets in the cosmos. And if one gathers together many of the herbs, the minerals, the metals, jewels, perhaps even animal products that correspond with a particular planet, then one can invoke the qualities of that planet into one's life. In alchemy, for example, we can see the correspondence of particular metals to specific planets. So gold with the sun, silver with the moon, quicksilver or mercury with Mercury, copper with Venus, iron with Mars, tin with Jupiter, and lead with Saturn. To give an example of the range of correspondences, just with one planet, Venus's dance with the Earth and the Sun, it takes 8 years to trace out a five-petaled star in the heavens. And thus we see this shape, this five-pointed shape corresponding to materials sacred to Venus. Venus, who is the principle of love and beauty. So the rose, which is so commonly a symbol of love, comes from the Rosaceae family. And the Rosaceae family, for anyone who's interested in botany, it's defined and identified by its five-petaled structure. And not only roses, the whole range of types of roses, cultivated, wild, are from this family, but other things like strawberries and raspberries are part of the Rosaceae family. And these sensual fruits we often associate with romantic occasions. Now, from the rose plant, we can go to the rose quartz, that pink stone that's said to nourish the heart. Another example is the sweetness of honey reflects the sweetness of Venus's archetypal qualities. If you've ever seen the planet Venus shimmering above the horizon after sunset or before sunrise, sparkling like a diamond bursting forth from the heavens, you can understand why this planet was associated with beauty, attraction, desire, and love. And with the material form of the diamond, for that matter, a gem we often use to symbolize eternally enduring love. So you can start to see how these kinds of correspondences work. And every planet has numerous earthly correspondences from the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms. So with astrological magic, one gathers together the corresponding materia at a specific moment chosen for its astrological favorability. So selecting for a chart that emphasizes whatever qualities one is hoping to cultivate more fully in one's life. So it's a similar idea as the birth chart, reflecting the life and character of an individual. But instead of the birth of a human being, it's the birth of a particular prayer or an intention or an invocation. So magic is an intentional aligning of all the archetypal factors from the celestial and terrestrial planes so that a full correspondence and orchestration of a particular archetypal quality can be invoked. Okay, but how does any of this actually make sense? Because to approach magic in our contemporary era, we have to deconstruct the worldview that we're seeing through. We have to go back through time to see what the world looked like to those who developed and practiced magic in earlier eras. And then we have to see why our own modern era cannot recognize such magic and dismisses it as the work merely of fiction. But what is fiction anyway? So, even though I intended to speak about something new and experimental, I found I actually had to go back into my academic roots in order to find a to construct, to build a foundation for this experiment to stand on. I cannot just accept magic on its own terms. I have to understand it within the context of the evolution of consciousness that has unfolded in myriad ways around this globe since humanity first awakened as a conscious species. So today, or this evening, I want to take you on a philosophical journey by traveling through a variety of different worldviews. So moving through a few eras in history that saw the world differently than we do today, or than our parents and grandparents each did, depending on what our own personal worldview might be. So particularly, I want to contrast the medieval and modern paradigms. So looking to a time when the magic spoken of here was prevalent, and then looking to an era when that magic was scrubbed from the world, disavowed and disbelieved. So together we'll be exploring the idea of worldviews and how they shape our very perception and experience of the world around us. Now, we hear this term frequently, but what is a worldview? A worldview is a set of beliefs, theories, perceptions, understandings, and interpretations that we typically take for granted in our everyday lived experience. As an example of one of these theories or beliefs, what keeps our feet on the ground, or what keeps a dropping stone from falling up or sideways, we typically take for granted as gravity. We also may take for granted that we're all separate individuals, defined to a certain degree by the boundaries of our skin. We have individual interiority, thoughts and emotions of our own that we experience inside ourselves. So we could say that our worldview is the immersive water in which we swim, which can often make it difficult to perceive. Our paradigm shapes our world. So studying your worldview will inherently start to bring cracks in the facade, if not the foundation as well. Simply by asking yourself, what qualities of the cosmos do I take for granted, and how might I be more conscious of them, can begin this life-changing process of transforming and opening your worldview. The tradition of astrological magic arises from a worldview, or better said, a complex history of evolving worldviews, quite different from the modern reductionistic scientific paradigm. The world itself looked quite different to an ancient Greek citizen than it did to a medieval Christian theologian. And both look starkly different from a modern scientific cosmologist. So just to explore one shift from the ancient Greek to the medieval European Christian, we can look at their different understandings of the divine. For an ancient Greek philosopher such as Plato, the idea of infinity indicated chaos. Therefore, to be perfect, the divine must be bounded and limited. Now, as Hellenic thought was exposed on the one hand to Hebraic consciousness, as well as the mystery religions of Alexandria, these different influencing streams, Neoplatonism developed. And with it came a new conception of the divine as infinite. So this conception of the divine as infinite was actually inherited by Christian theologians who then saw God as an infinite being who gifts existence to creation by limiting his infinite potential into finite creative beings, such as human beings, plants, animals, and so forth. So in some ways, we can see the same conception of infinity inherited by the modern cosmological worldview, which perceives the universe to be so vast, it may as well be infinite. For some, that brings up internal feelings very much like the Greeks. Infinity is chaos, and the universe has emerged through random chance collisions. But for others, that same understanding of the cosmos as infinite can actually inspire feelings of great freedom, a recognition that we live in an open universe, brimming with creative potential that we can participate in. I want to contrast two distinct worldviews so you can recognize how one's paradigm really does shape the world we see and experience and inhabit. It's not just ideas, it's our lived experience. So for these two examples, as you can already see, I'm situating myself within the so-called Western world, which is, of course, a culturally porous world. As this is my own lineage and the history with which I'm most familiar. So now let us enter, through the imagination, into the world of a medieval European, living at the time when some of the great alchemical texts and magical grimoires, such as the Picatrix, were composed. When this medieval person looks at the sky, she sees not a void or empty space. Indeed, there wasn't even a word for space like we have now. As this would be impossible, as a space would be impossible in nature. Rather, she would see a complex structure. If it was daytime, she would see light radiating from a living sun, just as our body, the blood in our body, pulsates from a living heart. If it was nighttime, the vastness of the sky would not be open space separating the stars by trillions of miles. There would be nested crystalline spheres upholding each of the planetary bodies, perfectly circular crystalline spheres. Now, what's important to remember about a worldview is that for this medieval person, she would have seen these translucent planetary spheres, not literally in the sense that we see the hand held up before our eyes, but with an inner sight that knows inherently that these spheres exist. It would be taken for granted. Furthermore, these spheres are emanating celestial music, an inaudible music that is nonetheless perceivable. Now, there's a greater sphere surrounding these planetary spheres, and that sphere contains the stars, the constellations, and the great belt of the zodiac. The world is contained within these nested spheres for the medieval individual, and the earthly realm is at the heart of it. Below the sphere of the moon, the sublunary realm is the domain of the four elements, so fire, earth, air, and water. And out of these elements, the entire sublunary realm is created, including our own bodies. The four humors of the body are made up of these four elements, and the balance of each for each individual makes up our personal temperament. When we see a stone fall, what pulls it to the earth is not gravity, but rather an inherent attraction of earthly substance to earthly substance, something that looks more like desire or longing. So each element longs to be in its right place. Throughout the earth, different substances belong to or are beholden to the different planets, which of course is the great wealth of knowledge needed to practice astrological magic. It may be tempting to stay within this worldview. I know I would like to spend more time there. But let's come now into a different paradigm. Not necessarily a completely contemporary 21st century worldview, but the paradigm of the mid-20th century modern individual. This is a world that has gone through the Copernican Revolution, recognizing not the Earth as the center of the cosmos, but the sun as the center of the solar system. The heavens themselves are now terrestrial. They're no longer perfect crystalline spheres, but planetary bodies formed of mineral and gas, whirling through a new medium of space. While Isaac Newton, at the height of the scientific revolution, laid forth the mathematics of gravity and planetary motion, by the early 20th century, some of his own paradigm assumptions were also coming into question. As new discoveries brought forth the theories of relativity and eventually quantum physics. Now, still, for the sake of illustrating a lived worldview, most of us are still not living within the quantum universe. We are living within a blend of Newtonian classical physics with a taste of Einsteinian relativity. Einstein's own theories introduced the conception of an expanding universe, an idea that so disturbed Einstein that he fudged his calculations, introducing what he called the cosmological constant to keep the universe fixed. So the idea of an expanding universe was more than Einstein's belief system could handle, much in the same way that for the ancient Greek, the idea of infinity indicated chaos. The assumptions we take for granted within our worldview matter greatly. And when a new theory backed by the evidence enters our world, it can shake us to the foundations. So just as the Copernican Revolution turned the world upside down, unchaining the Earth and setting it spinning through space, the relativity and quantum revolutions had a similar effect upon the scientists studying them, which sadly led a few distraught individuals even to take their own lives because of this inability to reconcile their worldviews. One of the great assumptions of the early 20th century modern paradigm, an assumption that's been carried from the beginning of the scientific revolution, was that the world was a predictable chain of cause and effect. And eventually, this would be understood down to the most minute detail. This is the assumption that the scientists were operating under. So while this belief began as a faith in God's creation, it's an important part to remember about the turn into the scientific revolution. It was the belief that the mind of God was understandable, and therefore creation could be discerned. But eventually, over the course of the scientific revolution, this shifted away from God and instead became a kind of faith in materialism. So the great difference between the modern worldview and the medieval, and indeed between the modern and any other lived worldview from around this globe, was the belief that the world was material, while only the human being was endowed with meaning, purpose, and intelligence. And it's within the heart of this materialist worldview that a great anomaly began to creep in. And this is the experience of synchronicity. So I want to turn now to a figure whose life and work has greatly fascinated me. This is the Swiss depth psychologist, C.G. Jung. Jung was raised within this modern Western materialist paradigm. And although his father was a Christian pastor, it was very clear to Jung that his father's faith was slipping away and that Christianity did not hold the mystical power that it once did within the Western world. Jung was of a scientific mind. He studied medicine and psychiatry, eventually moving into the world of psychology, the study of the psyche. And as Jung established himself in the professional world, he eventually reached a crisis point. He was being overwhelmed by visions and fully encompassing fantasies. And he was starting to doubt his sanity. This began in 1913 for Jung. He thought he had unleashed a latent psychosis, a state similar to what he had witnessed amongst his schizophrenic patients. What he came to realize was that over the course of his time establishing himself in the professional world of modern science and medicine, he lost his connection with his soul. So this is how it came to be that one November night in 1913, Jung found himself calling out, my soul, where are you?" And it took multiple nights of such calling, writing down his experiences, trying to make contact with an inner world he had lost. But eventually, she answered. The soul answered. And she was pissed. She was so furious. When the soul finally spoke to Jung, she said, "Do you know then who I am? Have you grasped me, defined me, and made me into a dead formula? Have you measured the depths of my chasms and explored all the ways down which I am yet going to lead you?" The scientific reductionist approach to psychology, which literally translates psychology, psyche, logos as this language of the psyche, had been trying to reduce soul to a dead system. So indeed, Jung's loss of his soul spoke to a much larger problem with the disenchanted modern paradigm. The West had lost its soul and needed to embark upon the descent to recover it, to recover that meaningful relationship. Jung's personal journey in relation to soul, he recorded in the great book he came to call Liber Novus, which is better known as the Red Book. These profound, visionary, imaginal experiences that Jung underwent became the primary foundations of his analytical psychology, leading to his development of such concepts as psychological types, the individuation process, psychological archetypes, including the archetype of the self, and an understanding of the collective unconscious as the mythic ground of all human experience. One key theory that first emerged during Jung's Red Book period later on became a central concern of his thought. This is a phenomenon that Jung began to notice in his practice as well, both in his own lived experience and also amongst his patients. Jung came to call this phenomenon synchronicity. A synchronicity is a meaningful coincidence between one's internal state of consciousness, such as our thoughts, our emotions, perhaps a dream or an internal image. So a coincidence between this internal state and then an outer event that symbolically reflects the interior state. What is important is that there's no causal connection between the inner and outer events. They just happen to occur within the same period of time. They are usually experiences that take us by surprise. They catch our attention, and there's a feeling of wonder, awe, and numinosity present. Jung gives a significant example of a synchronicity in his essay on the subject that illustrates this phenomenon well. Now, some of you may have heard or read this story before, but it's worth recounting here as it's a paradigmatic example. Jung had a patient who was rigidly rational. She was trapped by her Cartesian education, and any progress they were making in her psychological treatment was continuously blocking her ability to rationally explain away anything meaningful. Jung concluded that something truly irrational would have to intervene, as it was beyond his ability to shift her perspective. So one day, she was telling him about a dream she had the night before, in which she was being given a costly piece of jewelry shaped as a golden scarab. As she was speaking, Jung heard a tapping on the window of his office, and distracted, he went to the window. And to his great surprise, he saw a beautiful beetle tapping at the window as though it was trying to get into the room. The insect was a rose chafer beetle, which is the closest relative to a scarab living in those northern latitudes of Switzerland. So he quietly opened the window and gently carried the beetle inside in his hand. As his patient was finishing recounting her dream, Jung opened his hand with the words, "Here is your scarab." Now, the impact of this unexpected coincidence of a scarab-like beetle coming into the room right as Jung's patient was describing her dream so shocked the woman that it cracked the rational foundations of her worldview and allowed a deeper sense of meaning and soulful connection to break into her life. From this pivotal moment forward, as Jung describes, they were able to proceed successfully with her psychological treatment. The world itself had seemingly orchestrated this woman's connection with soul, the soul of the world, the anima mundi. Jung collected numerous instances of such meaningful coincidences, and he coined a name for them, synchronicity. It's a beautiful word, and one we often use today, although sometimes I notice it can be misapplied. The etymological roots of the word synchronicity are Greek, coming from syn, which means together, and chronos, meaning time. The synchronicity means a coming together in time. Jung differentiated synchronicity from synchronous, which indicates two events occurring at once that may or may not be related. So a synchronicity involves two factors. One, an unconscious image surfaces into consciousness, such as a dream, an idea, or a feeling premonition. And then two, an external event occurs simultaneously with no causal connection that carries the same meaning. So what really defines a synchronicity versus a mere coincidence is its relationship to meaning. A synchronicity is a meaningful coincidence between an inner and outer event in which the subjective state, our inner experience, is reflected in the outer event without there being any direct causal connection between the two. What the inner and outer event share in common is an archetypal core. The symbolism is the same. So to narrow this definition even further, the meaning inherent to a synchronicity plays a significant role in an individual's healing and their movement towards psycho-spiritual wholeness. The experience of the synchronicity carries a feeling of numinosity, of sacredness, and it can bring about a spiritual awakening, an awakening to an interconnected reality that unifies the psyche with the cosmos. Now, I imagine each of you have had certain experiences of synchronicity in your life. And perhaps as I describe this, you can recall some of your own personal examples. The more attuned you are to the synchronization of events and their symbolic nature, the more the universe seems to want to show these experiences to you. So really, we need a naturalist's keen perception of the environment, viewing the natural world as a ground for symbolic expression. Now, synchronicities do also have a shadow side. When we're not sufficiently psychologically aware, paying close attention to synchronicities can lead to a kind of self-referential aggrandizement. So we do need to develop balanced discernment, cultivating a humble attunement to the larger whole beyond our individual selves. Now, sometimes in life, just like the periods when we struggle to remember our dreams, sometimes we go through long periods in life that are synchronicity dry spells. And at other times, it can feel like the synchronicities are popping up everywhere, like mushrooms surfacing from the network of mycelia after a warm rain. Synchronicities are like these fruiting bodies of fungi because they indicate a vast and interconnected network that's hidden below ground. The mushrooms are simply the temporary indication of that extensive mycelial network. Just like the synchronicity, that experience is the temporary indication of the interconnected archetypally patterned order of reality. Synchronicities often have a very personal nature to them, although I do think we can understand the phenomenon of synchronicity in some collective cases. My own research into the numerous parallels between Jung's Red Book and J.R.R. Tolkien's Red Book of Westmarch is one such collective case, but I won't go into that now. Because of their intimate and personal nature, oftentimes we want to guard the experience of a synchronicity, guard it in the same way we would a precious jewel, keeping it hidden and sharing it only in the most sympathetic settings. Indeed, the numinosity of a synchronicity can be soured or even lost by sharing it at the wrong time or with the wrong person. And some synchronicities involve too many complex personal details and chains of events to make a good public story, even if the event was life-changing for the individual. Jung began using the term synchronicity in the late 1920s, but he didn't publish on the subject until the early 1950s. He accumulated a great deal of evidence from his clinical practice and personal life, which formulated the anecdotal foundation of the theoretical principle. So he had conversations with Albert Einstein and with the physicist Wolfgang Pauli, and these helped shape Jung's understanding of the principle within the context of modern physics. Jung saw the synchronicity principle as a challenge to the conception of the world depicted by the modern scientific paradigm, the paradigm of classical physics, which is dependent upon the notion of direct causality. So this notion of direct causality is the belief that every effect must have a cause, even if that cause is not apparent yet to scientific observation. So from this perspective, there's the belief that with enough scientific inquiry, the causal relationship will be found. We can explain it away. In Jung's monograph, Synchronicity, an A-causal connecting principle, this is the monograph where he first expressed this theory, he gives this key example of a synchronicity, the story I just shared of the woman with the golden scarab. It's a paradigmatic case, not just a simple example of synchronicity, but the archetypal pattern of synchronicity itself. Anyone who studies Jung and synchronicity has probably heard this story over and over and over. And the reason is because it has all the key qualities of a synchronicity. It's the synchronization in time between the woman describing her dream and the arrival of the scarab beetle at the window. It's the lack of a direct causal connection between the dream and the beetle. There's no way her dream caused the beetle to show up. Even the improbability of the beetle tapping against the window and drawing Jung's attention. There's the psycho-spiritual breakthrough for the woman with the recognition of the synchronicity, and then the overall sense of numinosity that's inherent to the scene. So what connects the acausal events of a synchronicity is the archetypal meaning coming through each event. In the case of the scarab beetle synchronicity, Jung identified the archetype running through the acausally connected events as rebirth. So the scarab is a symbol of rebirth coming from Egyptian cosmology, and it's related to the daily journey of the sun dying into the west, traversing the underworld realms below the earth, and then being reborn anew at dawn in the east. The experience for Jung's patient led to a rebirth of her worldview as her former Cartesian rationalism underwent a deconstruction, and a new, more holistic perspective of the world was born. Part of the key to the synchronicity principle is the recognition that the specific events themselves could be different, so long as the archetypal core remains the same. So some other dream or symbol of rebirth could have happened, and there could have been a different external event. The archetype itself is the essential element of a synchronicity. The symbolism of rebirth that is informing archetype of the synchronicity indicates a psychological rebirth, not only for Jung's patient, but also a rebirth for the modern worldview, in which the severed connection between the interiority of the psyche and the exteriority of the world are linked and reforged once more. This is why it's a paradigmatic case. A key element of the scarab beetle synchronicity is Jung's own participation in the event. As the woman was speaking, Jung heard that tapping of the beetle on the window. But rather than ignoring it, he quietly stood up, opened the window, and retrieved the beetle. His statement to his patient, "Here is your scarab," makes the synchronistic event complete. Without his essential role, the breakthrough for the woman would not have occurred. Because of Jung's particular life experiences, he was an individual who was unusually attuned to the patterns of the natural world. He was always making note of significant or unusual occurrences. If he heard the lake lapping louder outside his office window, or if he saw several birds fly across the horizon during a session, he would note whether these natural events had any symbolic significance to the material at hand. Jung had an epistemological openness to the idea that meaningful coincidences can carry genuine knowledge and significance. He was able to view the world through a symbolic lens that allowed him to perceive the archetypal principle connecting the inner and outer events of a synchronicity. Jung had a highly developed and subtly attuned archetypal eye, as James Hillman calls it. Because I'm speaking about the archetypal core of meaning that is inherent to a true synchronicity, I feel that a few words on archetypes themselves might be appropriate at this moment. The word archetype is one that is frequently used in astrology, although the exact meaning may be somewhat elusive. And this is for a good reason, since our understanding of archetypes, or what the term archetype refers to, has shifted over the millennia. The philosophical theory of archetypes really emerged with Plato in ancient Greece, and the word that he used for them was ideas or forms. The Platonic forms are universal principles that inform and give shape to the world around us. For example, every tree in the world, the great variety and diversity of trees, every species and every individual tree within each species, they all participate in the archetypal principle or the Platonic idea of tree with a capital T, or tree-ness. Another example that Plato often likes to give is the idea of the horse with a capital H, or horseness. Every particular and individual horse participates in the form of horse. A more abstract example is that of beauty. A beautiful flower, or a sparkling gem, or a gorgeous, lush landscape, an exquisite sunset, the face of one's beloved. These are all very different, particular manifestations, but they are all beautiful to the degree that they participate in the archetypal form of beauty. Our word archetype comes from the Greek word archai, A-R-C-H-A-I, which means first principle. Plato understood these archai to be dwelling in a transcendent realm that's beyond our earthly plane. But the two realms participate in each other by means of a middle realm. This middle realm he called the metaxy, and daemons traverse this middle realm, communicating between the heavenly and earthly domains. Now, Plato's student, Aristotle, conceived of a different means of understanding how such universals related to particulars. Aristotle saw the universals as immanent rather than transcendent. And he thought the human mind abstracts these categories from the particulars we see every day, and we recognize them to be universal categories. So rather than there being an archetypal tree dwelling in a transcendent domain, Aristotle thought we abstract the form of tree from the many trees that we perceive, and thus we create a categorical universal, the category of the human mind. Now, this great difference between Plato and Aristotle is beautifully illustrated in the Renaissance master Raphael's painting, The School of Athens, where these two great philosophical giants are depicted at the center. Plato is pointing upwards towards the transcendent heavens, and Aristotle is directing outwards towards the immanent world. This distinction between these two philosophies of archetypes, it has less to do with these two individual Greek men, who at this point are more like mythic figures of the philosophical imagination than actual living people. It has more to do with how these transcendent and immanent perspectives went on to shape different philosophical and religious streams in the millennia that followed. The debate between the two worldviews was carried south, east, west, and north at different times in history, and we can trace their threads and mutual influences in many various cultures and traditions. But ultimately, at its core, it's the philosophical question of how universals relate to particulars, and the further questions of whether these universal principles are categories of the human mind, or are they of the world beyond the human being? Now, by the modern era, such universals were dominantly seen as interior categories of the human mind. That's the perspective that was winning out. And we can see that in, for example, Immanuel Kant's a priori categories. And this was the perspective that Jung inherited, although more and more of his experiences of synchronicity began to break down this fixed interiority. Jung's visionary encounters with the collective unconscious brought him face to face with these archetypal principles. But in his experience, they came as particular imaginal figures, figures that almost could be described like daemons. Out of these experiences, in conjunction with the material he drew from the records of his patients, Jung formulated the idea of psychological archetypes. Some of them bear the name of personified figures, such as the Great Mother, the Shadow, the Anima, the Animus, the Hero, the Divine Child, the Wise Old Man. We know these figures in some deep, familiar way. Jung also saw particular geometrical shapes as archetypal principles, shapes such as the mandala, the quaternity, the cross, and the spiral. Whole numbers, Jung recognized, might be the most fundamental archetypal principles of all. They create the very foundation of reality. Jung's recognition of number as the foundation of archetypes echoes Plato's decree 2,500 years earlier that anyone who would enter the Platonic Academy must have an understanding of geometry. This will be familiar to any astrologer who relies on a symbolic understanding of number to read astrological aspects, the geometrical angles formed between the planetary bodies. Ultimately, although Jung was committed for most of his career to the Kantian perspective that archetypes are interior psychological categories, and thus they have no bearing on the external world, the growing body of evidence of synchronicities began to erode this barrier between inner and outer. Jung had to start recognizing that archetypes are not just psychological principles. They are universal principles of the cosmos itself. And thus he came to recognize that archetypes are dipolar. They are psychological and material. They are spiritual and they are instinctual. Jung created a term for this quality of archetypes that's both psychological and material. The term is psychoid, and it was from the psychoid domain that synchronicities emerged. Jung's proposal of archetypes as psychoid suggests that it's the archetypes themselves that create this mysterious link between psyche and matter. Archetypes can manifest psychically and physically, and they can do so simultaneously, as we see with synchronicity. Jung saw synchronicities as evidence of the unus mundus, the one world spoken of by the alchemists. By definition, synchronicities are rare and usually personal events. But there's one extensive field of evidence that indicates synchronicities, in fact, are not rare at all. And that, of course, is astrology. Synchronicity has been one of the concepts by which contemporary astrologers can understand how astrology even works, especially when expanding out of the context of the modern worldview. This perspective indicates that the planets and their positions are not physically causing the events that unfold on Earth, but they're rather correlating with those events. So the planetary bodies can be understood like the hands of a clock. If the clock indicates that it's 12 p.m., the clock is not causing it to be noon. It simply correlates with that time. Now, one can understand the movement of the planets in the same way. Their positions indicate the quality of time in human experience, and their movements trace the ever-changing dynamics in individual human lives and in the larger patterns of collective experience in history. Astrology can thus be seen as a continuously ongoing, universally visible form of synchronicity, a meaningful coincidence between an outer event, the positions of the planets, and an inner event, the unfolding of human experience and history on the Earth. Furthermore, bringing a study of transit astrology into relationship with tracking one's personal synchronicities actually gives one a deeper understanding of the archetypal principles involved in the synchronicity. We can thus better understand the meaning of a synchronicity that happens to us by looking at the transits at that particular moment in time. Synchronicity restores a concept that has been missing in the modern worldview. And that is the notion of complex causality. If we look to ancient Greece and turn again to the philosophy of Aristotle, we will learn that Aristotle proposed four different forms of causality. These four forms are material cause, efficient cause, formal cause, and final cause. Now, material cause is simply the matter or material of which a physical substance is made. Efficient cause is the antecedent or the prior condition that brought the substance about. It can be helpful to use the image of a billiard ball to illustrate this. The material cause, maybe I'll use my stone here. The material cause is the physical matter of the billiard ball. The efficient cause is the cue ball hitting the billiard ball, which in turn was efficiently caused by the move from the cue stick, which was in turn moved by the hand holding it, and so forth. Material and efficient causality are the only two forms of causality accounted for in classical physics, which is the physics of Newton that was dominant up until the quantum revolution. But Aristotle proposed two more forms of causality, which are directly relevant to our understanding of synchronicity. Formal cause is the defining characteristic of a substance. It is the form of or shape of something. It's the shape of a tree or of a butterfly. It's the spiral of a whirlpool or the Fibonacci sequence in a nautilus shell or the shape of a human being. In light of depth psychology, an archetype provides the formal cause to a psychological complex, or, as we've been speaking about, to a synchronistic event. The last type of causality that Aristotle described is the final cause. So final cause is the purpose of something. It's the teleology of the being. So to understand why something exists, according to Aristotle, we must look not to its beginning, but to its end. The final cause of the acorn is the oak tree. The final cause of the embryo is the adult animal. And the final cause of the soul, from the depth psychological perspective, can be individuation. The archetype of the self is the final cause that directs the individuation process. And synchronicities can be a guide along the stages of that process, indications of the final cause or telos of our soul. The principle of synchronicity, this acausal connecting principle, as Jung called it, actually restores these ancient forms of causality, the formal and final cause, to our conception of the world. Keeping in mind the multivalent nature of archetypes, I would suggest that the archetype does have a causal role to play in the synchronicity, but it's not the kind of efficient or material causality that's recognized by modern science. This is why Jung calls synchronicity acausal, because it's not efficiently or materially caused, but the archetype gives the events their form and also their equivalence in meaning. Thus, the archetype can be seen as the formal cause in the Aristotelian sense of the synchronicity. The role of time in a synchronicity is another key element, as is apparent from the very name, sun chronos, a falling together in time. A synchronicity points toward the archetypal quality of that moment in time. Now, how long a moment lasts depends in part on the archetype being constellated in that moment. So a synchronicity can be exactly simultaneous. There can also be a lapse of some hours or days or even months, depending on the kind of event. From the Jungian perspective, synchronicities cannot be predicted or replicated, which is part of why they pose such a challenge to the scientific method. We can't replicate them in a lab, but they can be understood probabilistically. A synchronicity may occur if an archetype is constellated. And if it does occur, then we can infer it will carry the same meaning as the archetype. But how can we discover if an archetype will be constellated? This is where the role of astrology comes in, and why I have taken us on this long journey through worldviews, archetypes, and synchronicity. Although I've given here philosophical and psychological definitions of archetypes, there's a much older word that can encompass the many meanings of the word archetype: gods. What Plato was trying to articulate in philosophical language and Jung in psychological language was an understanding of the great gods and deities of the ancient mythic worldview. The universal archetypes are present in different guises in the various pantheons of the world: Greek, Roman, Egyptian, Babylonian, Vedic, Norse, Celtic, Mayan, Yoruba, and so forth. So when I speak of the eternal forms and the archai, the universals and the archetypes, I am also speaking about gods. These gods come forth in different manifestations depending on the cultural conditions and the individuals who are enacting them through participatory relationship. The practice of astrological magic relies on astrological timing techniques that allow one to know when a particular archetype or combination of archetypes will be constellated. It is the practice of predicting when a synchronicity will occur, and then aligning oneself along with the appropriate archetypally relevant materials with that qualitative moment in time. It is defying what the modern perspective believes, that synchronicities are unpredictable and anomalous. And when we align ourselves with the archetypal threads of synchronicity, that is when literal magic happens. Anyone who has experienced a synchronicity knows this. You feel it in your being. The inner and outer worlds align, and the archetypal core of meaning, the presence of the God, radiates through every dimension in that moment of time, through you, through the materia, and through the world around you.
Thank you so much, Becca. I can see everybody clapping there.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. So there's a virtual round of applause. That was spectacular. Actually, I don't think I've ever experienced such a lucid, I can't say explanation because explanation is the wrong word, but a description of what you explore there while you allow the nature of what it is to remain implicit without drawing it out too explicitly. It was spectacular. Thank you so much. There are lots and lots of lovely comments as well, and saying thank you so much to Becca.
Thank you.
And also to everybody here for joining and your illuminating questions as well. So thank you so much for coming. And we do hope to see you again soon. And we'd love to have Becca back. We'd love to invite you back, Becca, for another talk in the future. That would be amazing.
Thank you all so much. It's just such an honor to be here. And thank you for the invitation this time. And it sounds like for next time as well.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Lovely to meet you. New friends and old friends, thank you. And we have lots of lovely talks coming up. So do keep up to date with what we're doing at the centre. Thank you so much. And thank you, Becca. See you all again soon. Bye-bye.